Islamic Relief USA is a nonprofit organization that provides relief and development in a dignified manner regardless of gender, race, or religion, and works to empower individuals in their communities and give them a voice in the world.
You done now? Can we start the podcast?
Okay.
Alhamdulillah wa salatu wa salamu ala rasulillah wa ala alihi wa sahbihi wa man walah.
It's a Water Relief podcast.
My name is Carl, and here with me...
Or are Mortimon. One of those two is correct.
I have messed this up.
Assalamu alaikum. Welcome back to the Water Relief Podcast. My name is Carl, and thank you everyone for listening, sharing, and repeating as our tagline goes. And don't forget, that's hashtag listen, hashtag repeat, and hashtag share. I can do this, and it won't sound bad, I promise. I want to start this episode by giving a special shout out to Ben. Ben, thanks for your email. Thank you for listening, and we hope you found the episodes you were looking for, and we'd love to see what project you include that in. So let's get into the show here. The hardest working man in the podcast industry, and, you know, quite beautiful, too, if I may say so myself.
It's so uncomfortable and awkward when you do that, dude. I mean, I was like, well, I'll just accept it. That's really nice. And then I'm like, it's a thing now. It's a thing. Thank you. But here, first, I want to point out something. Did you just say that we got a fan letter?
We did. Fan mail? We did.
Listener love? Is that what you were saying?
That was exactly what I was saying.
Well, can you share with some of the class anything about what it said? Just the good stuff. Unless it wasn't we'll just move on.
Ben was saying thank you for the awesome work we've been doing. And he was looking in particularly for... episode 17 that we did with Bilal on the issues in Myanmar with the Rohingyas. And Ben is working on some sort of project that he's going to include that in particular podcast in.
Sweet. Sweet. Hopefully we'll get a link to that project and be able to, you know.
Do you hear that? Do you hear that, Ben? We want a link to that project, whatever it is.
Right.
So, since you never told us who you were...
Oh, this is Mordant.
There you go.
I'm the mystery guest today. This is Mordant. I've been here for however many episodes, and yet you may not know my name or my face.
It's on the sticker.
It is. That's on the sticker.
It's on the sticker. That's right. So, Mordant, with us today. Yo. With us today is Min Kai Lu, who is a U.S. programs specialist. Assalamu alaikum, Min Kai.
Wa alaikum assalam. What's going on?
And as Mordant was saying, you have the perfect face for radio.
Oh, yeah.
Because that voice, you know, we were joking before the podcast started that we were just going to make this the smooth jazz hour. Welcome to WARP.
God's bounty is endless,
Dave,
my friend.
You know.
Do I need to be here for this?
Now, Min Kai Lu, part of the reason you're here is because you were on an episode of Success Freaks.
That's true, I was.
And Mordant, you were so moved by some of the stories that he told that you wanted to give him not just a segment like he had on Success Freaks, but you wanted to give him his own complete show.
I did. I thought he was a very well-spoken young man, and he should be given his due. But I just want to clarify something. He is a what was his job title again?
U.S. Programs Specialist.
For IRUSA.
Correct.
For IRUSA.
Ah, see, that kind of clarifies, like, for what? For, like, the government, or?
Just in general.
So, yeah, just in general. He just walks around being a U.S. Programs Specialist.
I had a bunch of business cards printed and,
yeah, exactly.
Just my face. U.S. Programs Specialist.
Oh my God. So let's talk about what we're going to talk about today.
So, Min Kai Lu, what does a U.S. programs specialist do here at IRUSA?
Right.
You put the USA in IRUSA.
That's correct. Well, you know, it actually varies pretty significantly. You know, we have some projects that we do which are pretty... I'll say relatively formulaic. We've done them for quite some time. We have Day of Dignity. We have the Qurbani program that we do, handing out the meat. We have, the new one, you know, the Ramadan food box distributions and Zakat programs, etc. But in the recent past, especially in the United States, we've really started to branch out in terms of how we work with the community and how we kind of develop and execute programs. And that's basically, I mean, I would say that I essentially work on those projects which aren't necessarily pre-existing or formulaic, you know, those instances where there's some more technical programmatic development or work that needs to be done. You know, I'm kind of like a programs fixer to a certain extent. For example, we work a lot with community-based organizations across the United States, and some of them who we fund for a certain project, some of them who are just sort of partners and people who we know and who are out there in the community doing good work. And in a lot of instances, these organizations are relatively new, and they don't necessarily have a very strong. They're strong in terms of the projects that they're doing and the way that they're bringing benefit to their community, but the structure of their organizations is not necessarily strong. You know, the way that they organize their operations, the way that they organize their programs, how they track their clients, how they track their impact, how they kind of really determine, actually see and determine how they're making an impact and whether they have made an impact and if they can be more effective and that kind of thing. A lot of groups that are new, they don't know how to do this. So in many instances, I'll work with community-based organizations like that and just do capacity development. It will vary from group to group. It will depend completely on what they need. You know, maybe they need to restructure their board. Maybe they need to formalize their programs. Maybe they need to implement client tracking systems to so they know the demographics of the people that they're serving more effectively. Maybe they need to restructure their whole organization. It really depends on you know what issues they're facing. But I did that pretty extensively for you know several years here. Traveled around and met with all these different groups, and oftentimes most of the time the groups that I worked with either ended up getting funding from us for particular projects or were funded already by us for particular projects, and so we were just kind of helping them to you know improve their ability to execute those projects. And now in the recent past, it's been more about kind of handling or creating unique programs, whether they are in the realm of emergency or long-term projects. You know, for example, Flint water crisis, which they asked me to go over there and basically create something from scratch, which ended up working out. And then you know, there was after that a refugee project, which is not finalized yet, but we're definitely, refugees are definitely one of our focus areas in the United States. That's something that's, you know, been discussed and confirmed over and over again. We're looking to expand the services we were able to provide for refugees, and that was a project that I was asked to work on for some time, and it's in its final stages now. Yeah, that's basically what I do, you know. I'm the guy that you call when you like, you know, it's, you don't know who else to call.
We don't call Ghostbusters, we call Minkai Lu.
So are you actually boots on the ground on any of these while it's going on, while the programs are happening?
Some of them, yeah. I more frequently will work kind of like around the program, and by that I mean, you know, once before they've begun, or once they've already started to be, once they've already started to implement a particular project, and they need to start to try to understand how effective it is, or if it's going well, or at the end of it, if they want to determine like how they can improve and kind of expand on that in the future. You know, that's more frequent. But recently, I've been definitely more, And boots on the ground, definitely, you know, you have to be out there and you have to be in the community to work with them in this way. So to a certain extent, yes. But I won't necessarily be around for like client service, you know, or anything like that. A lot of these projects are kind of they're very long term. You know, you're doing case management, you're working with people extensively, they're coming in, they're having interviews, and, you know, those aren't even necessarily things that I would sit in on. You know, that's a lot of that information is kind of private between the client and the case manager. But recently I've been, you know, more boots on the ground directly with programs, especially in Flint. You know, Flint, I was in Flint for almost a month, 2 months. It was about 8 weeks where I was going back and forth pretty extensively. I would come back. I don't even know why I came back to D.C., honestly. At a certain point, I would come back for like 2-3 days, maybe just do some laundry, you know, and then be out the next day. But
no, I do remember that because I remember because we run into each other a lot in the office here.
Right.
And there was a lot of times where I was like, where's Min Kai Lu? Where's Min Kai Lu? And they're like, he's in Flint. He's in Flint. He's in Flint. I'm like, hey, you, when did you get back? Yesterday. When are you leaving? Tomorrow?
Yeah, right. You should have just stopped asking after a while.
I know, right?
Forget it. He's gone.
Just accepted that he's like relocated.
So silly question, but it did cross my mind. But it's probably a silly question. You came back basically just to do laundry. Is that because you didn't want lead in your laundry, or?
Well, first of all, there's no silly questions. Only silly people. And
that's a new one.
That's awesome.
No, I mean there were a few things that I had to do, you know, in the office, procedural type of things, and working with some other projects. Still, it wasn't like I just was doing Flint. There were some other ongoing things, so you know, I had to. It was really annoying, though. I'll be honest. Yeah, it was really annoying having to fly back and forth like that. I should have just stayed there, honestly. By the end of it, I was like, I might as well just buy a house in Flint. They're giving them away.
Wow.
Yeah, but there would have been so many repairs to that because I was with you when IRUSA periscoped your. I think it was the question and answer session for long-term repair brainstorming for the Flint area.
Yeah.
And I know you and I talked about the fact that all of those houses, they have to now have new water heaters, and they have to have new plumbing, and they have to, because it's in my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, but the Flint government is going to cover up to the house.
Yeah, well, the government exactly is going to be, I mean, ultimately the municipal government is responsible for the pipes that are for the general public, you know, whatever that means, the ones that are moving water through the system. But once it gets to your house, you know, you're responsible for that. So a lot of people even have old, they still have old piping in their homes, you know, and I think copper is the new thing. Everyone has the copper pipes, and those are, from what I understand, relatively expensive.
Of course, even. It's copper,
right? Copper is, you know, I've actually been in neighborhoods where people, when houses would be in development, I was talking to some lady once. We were driving around. She was a realtor, and she was telling us that, you know, you want to do redevelopment, because we were talking about redeveloping houses, low income housing development. And she was like, yeah, you want to redevelop houses in the neighborhood? Like, that's cool, but you got to do it real quick. And she was like, I was like, why? You know, she said, oh, you leave these places gutted out for even a day, they're going to come in and steal all your pipes, every single piece of copper you have in the wall,
and the wiring, everything.
They'll take it all. Like, you better close that house off, have a gate around it, shotgun outside, everything. Yep. But anyway, America, man. But anyway, I think that for the pipes in the people's houses, they would be personally responsible for those. And most people won't be able to afford that. You know, honestly, I think that what will happen in the future in Flint is what happens in America quite frequently, unfortunately, when it comes to people who are in poverty. As the crisis, you know, starts to bring in a lot of dollars, because you'll see grant money coming in, you'll see government funding coming in, government subsidies, et cetera, et cetera. You'll have a lot of developers who will move in to access that money. That's how it tends to happen. I'm sure you already have, and people there know that there are already developers who have certain visions for the city and how it's going to be in the next 5 to 10 years. And most of those visions probably will not include much of the current population of Flint, you know, and that's the nature of these things. You know, once money starts to flow in, it becomes a place for people with money. And that seems to me to be the most likely outcome of a scenario such as Flint, which everyone will probably, as it happens, look at it as the greatness of you know, this country and the ability to develop, and, you know, it'll be lauded as a great success story. But unfortunately, you know, the people, this country is composed of more than, you know, one class of people. And as they often are, those people will probably be left out of the recovery, the real recovery in Flint. And so I'm a little bit apprehensive about the future of that city, having spent so much time there and kind of developed an affinity for not only the place, but the people, definitely the people, more so obviously the people, you know.
What was your experience with the people there? I mean, while you were there with Flint, you say it was different than your other projects, as you were actually there. So
yeah.
I'm sure you were either working with the people or at least helping people. What was your experience with them?
Right. Well, exactly. Because Flint was almost almost an emergency response thing, but not exactly, because it wasn't a natural disaster. But the way we were going about it was sort of like an emergency, a response to an emergency that you might flood or hurricane or whatever. And we were working with the Red Cross and some other organizations. And the funny thing about all of that is that, you know, the emergency was that there wasn't enough water. So for the most part, you know, it was a scarcity of that particular resource. So for the most part, what we were involved in was trying to get that resource out to the people in a kind of regular, regimented sort of fashion, so they didn't have to worry about where their water was coming from on a regular basis. And ultimately, we ended up doing weekly deliveries, which we're still doing now, actually, until the end of August. And there are plans to establish local distribution points in every neighborhood. So hopefully that will be fully implemented by the time our project ends, which is what our intention was. But, you know, so we started delivering water on a weekly basis to all of the low-income housing units, the public housing units, all of Flint's public housing units, literally every single one. And, you know, you go through the houses and you go through the apartment complexes and you see people and you talk to people, and, you know, they were very... There was a real strength that I saw to the people in Flint. And I know everyone always says that, oh, whenever there's a disaster, these people are so strong or whatever. But it's true, you know. I went and I sat in many people's homes. We went and we distributed water one day, the first weekend that I was there. And the very next day, I went back to that same neighborhood. And I just started walking down the streets and knocking on people's doors. And be like, hey, do you have a minute to talk about the situation here? And Fariha was actually our one of our communications people here. She was with me at the time. And, you know, we just knocked on people's doors. And it started off as sort of like a needs assessment. But ultimately, honestly, we just started talking to people about what was going on with them, what their experiences were. And, you know, people were, they were certainly distressed and upset with their circumstances, but you really saw this resiliency. Like, they were like, this is our home, they're not going to kick us out, we know what they're trying to do to us here, we know they don't care about us, but that doesn't matter, like, this is where we're from, you know. I've been here, my kids have been here, you know, my parents were here, this is our community, this is our neighborhood. And, you know, they're not gonna, if we let them push us out, we're just going to be another story like that in America, another story of a community that was kind of removed from their homes and from their place of residence where they had been for decades upon decades, because they were considered undesirables generally, you know. And so I was kind of shocked. I was shocked at how aware people were of that mentality, of that possibility, and their kind of resistance against it, and their willingness to stay there and deal with, you know, the situation they were in. And also, I mean, they were just so grateful, these people. They were so kind, you know. And it wasn't like a sense of gratitude, like, you know, sometimes you go to places and you do things for people and they're very grateful, and it's almost to the point that it makes you feel uncomfortable, because, you know, they are the same as you. They're a human being. They're a person. And, you know, I remember once I was working at a food pantry, and this lady was like hugging me for like 20 minutes, because she was like, oh, can I have an extra bag of pasta? And I was like, sure, go ahead, take it. And she was like hugging me. She's like, oh, thank you so much. You're so, you know, whatever. And I felt so, I mean, I know people humanitarian field won't say this a lot, but I felt really weird. You know, it felt very strange for me because I was like, I've had really good pasta in my life and I've never reacted to it by like going and hugging the waiter, you know? And it's reflective of a very uncomfortable situation for us who are not even necessarily, I'm not rich by any means, you know? I'm not a wealthy man. I don't drive a Benz. I don't have any kind of many fancy things or whatever. I mean, I have some, sure, but you know, relative to the majority of people on this earth, I'm wealthy. I'm very rich. You know, I'm in the top 10% of the world. And, you know, working in this field and seeing that kind of reaction makes you come to terms with that. And it makes us feel weird about ourselves, you know, because you could be in their position just on at the drop of a dime. You know, something could turn tomorrow or the next day and you could be that person. And the fact that you're not that person now, you should be grateful every day. And you're not. You forget. You don't think about it. You become almost, you feel entitled. And I know that my level of entitlement is probably much lower than a person who like makes $1 million a year. You know what I mean? But still, I do have that entitlement, you know? And so personally speaking, it's something that it affects you, like mentally speaking. But anyway, I digress. My point was that they were grateful, but not in that way that made you feel weird. It was more in a way of like, we're all in this together and we appreciate this from you. And one day maybe we'll like be helping you or something like that. Like, and it was that kind of that, like, it was like a closeness almost, like you're helping your neighbor and your neighbor would be helping you the next day kind of thing. And I really appreciated that. And it was kind of encouraging to see that, because you don't want to feel like, you know, you're flinging change at a beggar or something. That's a bad feeling, you know. That's not a good feeling. Even if that money is helping them, you still have a bad feeling when you do that. And it's, I guess, because you feel more connected to those people and more connected to what they're going through. So that was a good experience. And also the general, like, they were fun, man. The curiosity, because when you have, like, there would be a whole, we brought so many volunteers with us, so you would have like 20-30 Muslim people running down the street in these neighborhoods, like in the middle of the hood, like literally in the middle of the hood. Like, we went to the worst neighborhoods. One of the neighborhoods that we went to, they called it the jungle. They were like, have you ever seen a Training Day? Yes. And they're like, you know that neighborhood that they go into, uh-huh, at the, where Denzel, like, you know, with all the gang, he's like, that's this. They were like, that's this neighborhood.
Oh, good.
So we were like, okay, cool. And we had like 16-year-old, you know, kids, you know, all these, you know, Pakistani people, Arab people, black Americans, yes, some white folk who came with us, all different kinds of people. You had people with the long beards, people who were dressed more traditionally. You had women with hijabs on. And you would see, like, whole armies of these people just coming through these neighborhoods, and they're looking at us like, who are these? Like, what is going on here? All wearing the Islamic Relief, you know, vests or whatever. I mean, we had a lot of interesting reactions. There was some genuine curiosity, because a lot of times, you know, when you travel around this country as a Muslim and are visibly so, the questions that you see in people's eyes are questions of your character, like your suspicious character. You know, they're looking at you like, you know, they're questioning you with their look, but it's like they're assuming that something negative is happening. Whereas, you know, we'd see these people and they'd be looking at us, questioning us with this look, but it's like, I'm just curious about who these people are and what they're about, like, because they're here, they're helping us, and this is a good thing, so they're good people, but I don't know much about them, so I want to find out. And a lot of them would just come over and ask us, you know, like, what's with this thing on your head? What's going on with all that? You know, what's you know, it was interesting. It was very interesting, that experience.
So I will tell you that one of my favorite things about just that, mm-hmm, was a Twitter exchange that took place constantly while you were in Flint,
uh-huh,
and the screen handle was Yola the Jew.
Yola the Jew?
Yeah.
Okay.
And she would tweet almost every week on the regular,
uh-huh,
thank you to Islamic Relief for bringing water to my house again.
Ah, really?
Thank you to Islamic Relief volunteers for all the work you did this weekend. I needed that water again.
Wow.
So that was one of my favorite things. It was like, you know what?
That's awesome.
We're helping regardless of race, gender, or religion, which is it's kind of in our mission statement.
Yeah.
But I mean, you know.
It's important. Yeah. Excuse me for I can run on a bit.
So no, just... you're good. The other thing that I would say is, if I'm not mistaken, now I want to make sure I get this right because I know it was kind of a long process.
Sure.
So the people of Flint are in an economically depressed area to begin with.
Right, for sure.
And then the water, they started getting sick, and they realized that the water was making them sick.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't pay the water bill. The water got shut off in a lot of the houses. And then because they couldn't pay the water bill, which they were paying for the poison to be delivered to them, but because all that happened, the government started taking their houses because they weren't paying their water bill and the water was shut off. And even like the parents who had little kids, the state would come in and say, you haven't paid your water bill. The children that live here have no water. Even though in the grand scheme, the water was just straight poison.
Right, right.
But then the state would remove the kids and put them into a place with, which we assume was clean running water. But, well, I mean, we don't know if, we don't know if they were in Flint or in the next town over or whatever.
No.
But, so it was kind of this whole catch 22 scenario.
This was a weird, you know, part of it, I think part of it is, you know, part of it was rumors that were exaggerated, but from truths, definitely from truths. Because I heard this so many times actually from people. They would say, and this was brought up actually when we would have, meetings of all of the nonprofit groups, all of the different community organizations that were involved in the Flint recovery, that they have weekly meetings. You know, we would hear this from residents a couple times. And it was definitely true that people weren't necessarily, like, I would assume that once this started, there would just be a moratorium on water bills, period. That was not the case.
I say, you would think that,
right?
But it was not.
The discussions that were being had were in the government at the time that I left were about like subsidizing people for their back due water bills. I mean, it goes to show you, of course, what the focus is always in oftentimes in these situations and in this country. It's about making sure that the businesses are taken care of first and foremost, because the government literally, as opposed to the businesses being responsible for the water that they had, you know, let people drink that was not adequate. I feel like these people owe the businesses owe the people of Flint money. The government is like, well, we'll help you to subsidize by subsidizing those businesses. You know, your tax dollars will now go to subsidize those same businesses that gave you bad water, as opposed to them being held responsible for what they've done. I mean, come on, you should be checking your stuff. Honestly, you should be checking what's going through your pipes on a regular basis, whether it was a private entity that was running the water system or a government municipality. I feel like if you're running a water supply system, you should be checking that every single day on the regular. There should be something, some probe, some kind of something in the water. I mean, I'm not a scientist or an engineer, but it seems pretty straightforward to me to think that you would have regular testing of water that's being pumped to an entire municipality, over 100,000 people. It doesn't make any sense that it's a shock to everyone that there's something wrong with this water. And whoever was responsible for that should not be receiving subsidies from our government to cover their costs. They should be covering the costs of the people who are going to have to pay medical bills now, who are going to have to deal with, you know, early childhood development programs for their kids to make sure that they actually are not having any kind of developmental disabilities in the future. They should be covering those costs as opposed to the reverse. But those were the conversations. The government was talking about, like, okay, we'll subsidize part of your back owed bills. And it was correct that there is a law in Flint that's on the books specifically about if you don't have running water in your home, you're not, it's considered to be a threat to your child. And so it's possible that they could come and take your child. I don't know if the government was really enforcing that policy, but we definitely heard stories from the people that they were coming and like telling them, look, we're going to take your kids because you don't you're not paying your water bills. And people were like, no, hell no, we're not paying our water bills. What are you talking about? It's not good water. And yeah, that was definitely so I think it's like there's definitely some truth to it. Maybe there's some exaggeration, but yeah, there was some weird things going on that are just you know, it's good enough for government work, you know what I mean? Kind of situation.
Assalamu alaikum. We are sorry to interrupt this riveting conversation, but the it does go on for a while. So we're going to cut this off here because we're over our normal time. But if you check back next week, you'll be able to find part two of the Min Kai Lu interview. So until next week, we will say assalamu alaikum.
And here with me...
Or our Mortimon. One of those two is correct.
I have messed this up yet again.
Yeah, I didn't know where you were going with all of that as well.
What are we doing?
Let's do it badly and then we can do it better.
Oh, excellent. That's the way I like to do.
Dun, dun, dun. Spoiler alert, spoiler alert.
Can we try that again? 1, 2, 3. Together for a better world. More stories, less yap.
What?
Yup.
That was just, it was so real.